This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, Engaging Minds Created in the Image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, are Christianity and science enemies or allies? Ken addresses that question today. Well, Ken, that's the perennial one, isn't it? Particularly when it comes to Reasons to Believe. And you suggest that there are necessary conditions that we need to address, 10 of them, in fact, that you want to flesh out on today's podcast and the next one.
That's right. I want to talk a little bit about Christianity's relationship to science. We live in a world where science, I think, and religion are the two most powerful enterprises in the world. And while Christianity and science have long had a unique and one might say cooperative relationship, there are people now, and there have been people in the past who have said that Christianity and science are at odds with each other. So I thought we would talk a bit about the philosophical assumptions that go into science, and we'll be looking at what I call 10 necessary conditions for science. And so in this program, we'll look at 5 and we'll carry it over to our next program.
All right. Sounds good. Let's get on with it.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the assumptions of science. That is, what kind of philosophical assumptions do people have? And we'll come back to these ideas a couple different times in the next couple programs. It seems to me, Dave, that one of the basic assumptions of science is that there's a real world out there.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's not, then it's hard to do science if there isn't an objective world. I mean, if we were to pump in the worldview of Hinduism for a moment, where the world may be illusory, it put a lot of scientists they put them out of work. There has to be a real world out there.
If you had that viewpoint, if you were a Hindu, I mean, I can imagine you could have grown up as a Hindu and not be worried about that. But if you really are a Hindu, then you think the world isn't real. Why do science?
That's right. And not only in the Eastern mystical religions, but if you thought, for example, if you were a Platonist, the great Greek philosopher Plato said that this world was kind of a Xeroxed copy of the ultimate world. Again, kind of not so much denying the existence of this world, but saying that it is less real. And so this idea of the world being real is critically important. And I, of course, want to tie that to the Judeo-Christian religions. Mm-hmm. It's the Bible that says there's a real world out there. God made it. It's good. It has qualities that are attractive, and we can study it. So, Joe, that's one of the assumptions. Two, that it's intelligible. The cosmos is actually intelligible. Now, that doesn't mean we understand everything about the universe. There is lots of mysteries, Dave, about the world in which we live. When we begin to study it and look at it, we realize that it stretches our minds. It takes everything we can to to study it. But that's an interesting point. The universe actually is understandable. And not only is the universe understandable, but we have the wherewithal, we have the ability to actually track some of that intelligibility. Mm-hmm. And
mathematics, you're thinking of.
Exactly. And logic and all of those elements that help us to study the universe. But why should that necessarily be so? I mean, let's pump in the worldview of naturalism for a moment. Why would necessarily the world be intelligible, and why should we be the recipients of the capacity to study it? Now, if God made the world, the Judeo-Christian biblical God made the world, and he made us in his image, and he networked the world and us together with him, then that makes a lot of sense. What I am beginning, of course, to lay down is the idea of why science would be a very friendly thing to a biblical perspective. The first one, that the world is real, that it's intelligible. Dave, you hinted at the next one, the validity of mathematics and logic, mm-hmm. that we can utilize these tools, mm-hmm. right? I've shared this story many times on various programs, but I remember taking physics in college, and it was a challenging class. They'd give you an equation, and then you had to kind of work out some kind of experiment. And I was like, I don't even know what the equation means, let alone the experiment.
This beautiful equation.
Yeah, and I'm just like, what the heck? There's too many numbers and too many letters mixed up in there. But one thing that I immediately began to recognize is the importance of mathematics. And this spurned in my own mind, why is it possible that thinking in the human mind could actually correspond to the nature of mm-hmm. reality?
There's I'm not going to jump, maybe you have this coming, but I want to
go ahead.
Mention of this article I read here several years ago by, I think it's this physicist, Eugene Wigner, or I can't remember if that's the right name or not, but he wrote this article sort of entitled something like The Incredible Correspondence
yeah.
Between Mathematics and the Real World. Something like this.
Right.
But the whole article was on the subject of, you know, math is something that is entirely within our mind. I mean, we don't look at the world and think about math. We think of math and then use it on the world.
Right.
It's something that's a product of our intellectual reasoning capabilities that we dream up and have concepts of mathematics. And yet we turn around now with these concepts of mathematics and find out that it corresponds with what we discover in the universe, in the physical world. And he's just absolutely flabbergasted that there would be this correspondence.
Yeah.
Being a naturalist himself.
Yeah, it's just kind of a stunning...
Unexpected.
An unexpected experience. Now, again, you know, as we think about the worldviews, you know, a worldview is your big picture of reality. Your worldview is how you make sense of, you know, a cluster of beliefs, your view of God, your view of the universe, your view of knowledge, your view of ethics. And so everybody has a worldview, and there are major worldviews. We call them, these are these big narratives, if you will, mm-hmm. the mega narratives, if you will. Well, if God made the world, and God is behind all of this, then this idea that there is a correspondence between mathematics, that mathematics is discoverable rather than invented. Mm-hmm. Now, not everybody agrees with this, Joe. Not everybody is willing to say, well, you know, I'll concede all of these points and the game is rigged. But what I want to lay down here very early in our program is it really does seem that there are basic assumptions that are necessary for science. And those assumptions seem to fit pretty well with a religious worldview. To be even more specific, they fit well with a theistic, a biblical worldview. Mm-hmm. And that would include things like our cognitive faculties, our cognitive abilities, and our sensory organs operating correctly. They're not perfect, right? We certainly need instruments to aid them in discovering things about the world, telescopes, microscopes, etc. But the mind works. our ability to see and observe works. And as Dave again suggested, that there's this congruence between the mind and physical reality. Now, the vast majority of the world's great thinkers would say that this is a sign that we live in a religious world. This is a sign that there is a mind outside of reality. You know, and so even somebody as skeptical as Immanuel Kant, who was critical of some of the arguments for God's existence, nonetheless believed that there is a mind behind the universe. René Descartes, the great Catholic philosopher, thought that there was a mind behind the universe. And even Plato and Aristotle, who were obviously not biblical in their orientation, these are philosophers who lived, you know, 400, 300 years before the birth of Christ. I don't see any evidence that Plato or Aristotle ever read the Hebrew Bible, for example. But in their own Greek way of thinking, they both thought there's something going on behind the universe. There is a reality that seems to order the way the world works. Now, people began, of course, to question that idea. But the vast majority of the great Christian thinkers of Western civilization have made that conclusion. Mm-hmm. And part of it is this experience of detecting the world and recognizing the kind of things, you know, our ability to be in touch with the world. Now, there is an author named Ian Barber, who is a big name in the area of both science and really in many ways has kind of written the definitive book, Religion and Science, kind of looking at how religion and science relate to each other. And he has what he calls the four ways of relating science and religion. And let me enumerate them. One is that they're in conflict. And this conflict narrative is very popular. In the 19th century, it became very popular. And you see it today in people like Jerry Coyne, his book, Faith Versus Fact, Why Science and Religion Are Incompatible. You see it in Lawrence Krauss, A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. So they would argue that there is this conflict. Barber's second way of looking at religion and science is to say that there is an independence. They're independent of one another.
Kind of the way Gould, non-overlapping.
Magisteria, yeah. Right. That's right. Gould picks this up and so sees them as they don't overlap one another. Mm-hmm. They're completely independent. Three is dialogue, that they are in dialogue with each other, that religion and science communicate back and forth to one another. I wonder if that is not the biologos perspective. Again, you know, this basic idea that Barber has taken has been developed by other people mm-hmm. in other terms. And then there's the fourth one, which is the most attractive one I can see to Hugh Ross, integration. That there is some kind of connection between science and religion. And that connection means that there is an agreement between the two. There is not just some kind of communication, but if it's understood properly, they're gonna cohere, mm-hmm. if you will. Now, what I'd like to say is that I find it interesting that a number of historians have taken this conflict narrative and they have critiqued it. Ron Numbers is a very well-known kind of science historian, and in his writings, he has pointed out that the narrative that religion and science are hostile to each other, in conflict with one another, is just simply not true in terms of history. In fact, here's another science historian, James Hannum. He had a book come out a couple years ago called The Genesis of Science. how the Christian Middle Ages launched the scientific revolution. And here's a couple quotes from his book. He says, "It's popularly imagined that the history of science and religion is one of violent conflict, but the facts don't bear this out." He then goes on to say, "The conflict between science and creationism is real enough, but it is the exception, not the rule. For most of history, science and religion have rubbed along just fine."
I like that quote.
They just rubbing along with one another. And, the idea of doing science involves the idea of a worldview. That if you're going to do science, you're basically approaching it like a worldview. And if you don't accept that from me, here's a quote from one of the distinguished physicists and cosmologists, Paul Davies, who's a professor at Arizona State University. This is from his Templeton Prize address. He says, "In the ensuing 300 years, the theological dimension of science has faded. People take it for granted that the physical world is both ordered and intelligible. The underlying order in nature, the laws of physics, are simply accepted as given, as brute facts. Nobody asks where they came from, at least they don't do so in polite company." He then says, "However, even the most atheistic scientist accepts as an act of faith that the universe is not absurd, that there is a rational basis to physical existence manifested as law-like order in nature that is at least part comprehensible to us." And here's the line I want to underscore. Davies says, "So science can proceed only if the scientist adopts an essentially theological worldview."
Wow.
So this idea that the world is, right, we started out looking at questions that there's a real world out there, that it's at least partly intelligible to us, mm-hmm. that we have a toolbox, math and logic, that help us to detect the intelligibility of the universe. The human mind and our cognitive abilities, our sensory abilities, they work pretty well. And that ultimately there is some kind of congruence. Now, again, I want to bring us back to this idea that this fits really well within a theistic context. This fits with what we would expect somebody to affirm if they were taking a biblical view. But what if I were an atheist? Why should I expect there to be intelligibility in the universe? Why should I expect there to be coherence between the human mind and objective reality via the tool of mathematics? None of that's guaranteed. None of that's guaranteed in a naturalistic worldview. And of course, here is where C.S. Lewis comes along. And I'm going to share just a word or two about him now. We'll come back to it a little bit later. But C.S. Lewis talked about the argument from reason. And Richard Pertill, a Christian philosopher, actually Catholic in his theological orientation, Pertill says in his book, C.S. Lewis's Case for the Christian Faith, he says, "One way of getting a preliminary insight into Lewis's argument from reason is to ask whether nature is the product of mind or mind is the product of nature. If God created nature, as Christians believe, then nature is understandable by reason because it is the product of reason." Now, I want to touch on that for a moment. If a mind created the universe, then it shouldn't be surprising that we can use reason, we can use logic, mathematics, the tools of understanding, right? If a mind made the universe, then it's not surprising that we can use the tools of math and logic to study intelligibility, because that intelligibility is the product of reason. we should expect it, right? But what if the reverse were true? What if nature created mind? What if nature is the one that's doing the creating? If mind is the product of nature, it's difficult because we have things like random accidental processes. We have seemingly no ultimate guiding hand, if you will. And so why is it that science has generally been pretty friendly, or why is it that religion and science have had a pretty close relationship? Because the early scientists thought that the universe was something that could be studied, and they thought it should be studied, and that it was made by a rational God, and that there would be benefits from knowing the nature of reality. And so, the early scientists, who were by and large Christians, they saw that as appropriate for the Christian worldview.
Ken, when it comes to this thought train that you were on here a moment ago, you mentioned Paul Davies. I think you mentioned somebody before on this podcast, or maybe it was Straight Thinking, your former podcast, who comes tantalizingly close to adopting, I don't know if adopting Christian worldview, you mentioned, I think it was Thomas Nagel, and in more disarming moments,
yes,
trying to wrestle with us this idea. But he doesn't adopt a Christian worldview, but he adopts a different kind of worldview, some kind of
panpsychism.
Yeah, panpsychism. What do you suppose he's getting at by adopting that worldview? If you don't mind there, because they're trying to wrestle with this, right?
Right.
And these are bright people, but they're not adopting the Christian worldview.
Yeah.
But what is it they're trying to do there? I think that might help somebody as they're trying to look at outs, you know.
Sure.
For the accounting for the brute facts of nature, you might say.
Yeah, there was a conversation just yesterday in a scholar lunch Mondays. For those listening, Mondays are typically a day in which we have a scholar lunch where all the scholars get together, bring their paper bag, and we talk a little bit. And
they don't breathe in the paper bag, right, Dave?
Sometimes if Fuzz gets a little excited, we might have him take a couple short breaths. Well, there was the question about, you know, these big issues. Origin of life, origin of humanity, origin of consciousness, these seeming challenges, you know, they seem almost intractable. How is it possible that life originated here on planet Earth? You know, and then how is it possible that we got to complex human beings? And then we look at things like consciousness. Where in the world do we explain these kinds of things? Joe, my thinking on this subject is that these are positions that are very, very difficult to explain from a purely naturalist point of view. Now, some naturalists will come along and say, hey, you know, give us time. We'll explain all of this. You know, don't rush us. Give us enough time, and we'll kind of explain all of these kinds of things. But I think a more honest, a more candid assessment is that these are seemingly intractable problems. These are issues that are very, very difficult for us to understand. You know, how do you have complex life when they don't come in a series? You know, everything is kind of thrown together, and you need everything working in sequence. How do we understand the complexity of life? Where does life come from? And you mentioned Nagel, Thomas Nagel. Nagel's looking at the question of the mind. How did mind come to be? And I thought what was interesting about Tom Nagel is that he ultimately says that Darwinian evolution in his mind, just can't explain human consciousness. That the naturalistic Darwinian way of coming at the issue of consciousness, he thinks has failed. He thinks it's inadequate. We need to put it aside and give consideration to something new. Now, Nagel, and I, like you, kind of do think about Paul Davies and Thomas Nagel in somewhat of a similar way. It's interesting that Paul Davies and Nagel, they know a lot about Christianity. They know a lot about religion. I mean, Tom Nagel says, it bothers me that some of my best friends are religious, you know, people like Al Plantica and others. And Nagel's very candid. He says, look, I don't, I really don't want there to be, I don't want reality to be historic Christianity. He said, I don't want that to be. But he says, it bothers me that some of the brightest people I know actually believe it. And, you know, I think Paul Davies has said something similar to that. Davies has said that, you know, if you were to accept a theistic interpretation, you might have to accept some of the things that come along with it, like the Christian church. And, you know, the Christian church is messy. The church history is messy, right, Dave? It's, it's a lot mess going on there, and lots of challenges and lots of difficulties. But Thomas Nagel ultimately said, Joe, that maybe we should consider another option, and that option is panpsychism. That is, maybe mind is connected to virtually everything in the universe. Maybe mind is everywhere. Because we can't come up with a way to explain how creatures without minds developed minds, maybe you start with it. And I would suggest that I think that's somewhat of a concession to the tremendous difficulty of coming up with an adequate explanation as to consciousness. That it is such a profound reality, it is such an intuitive reality that maybe to have it you have to begin with it. And of course, what does God say? I mean, God talks a lot about Himself in the Bible as being life in Himself. That God is beginningless and God is endless, and you know that. That God is the one who gives life.
So in a way, it's a concession to God.
I think it is. I think it is a concession to the fact that a naturalistic explanation, a purely naturalistic explanation of something as complicated as consciousness, that we have to think differently and maybe start with the idea. Maybe it's just everywhere.
Well, maybe it's sort of like a property of matter. It's like, you know, matter has charge or mass or it also has mind.
Yeah.
And when you bring a lot of matter together in various complex ways, it produces the kind of mind that we call mind or experiences mind.
Yeah. And so the old ideas of somehow, you know, through reductionism or the brain reaching a level of complexity and then, you know, an emergence of mind, these have been very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And all I'm doing here is simply kind of laying out the idea that, you know, that the intractable problems of life, of the complexity of life, of the emergence of human beings, of consciousness, that in a theistic sense, we not only need God to explain the existence of the universe, but we need God to explain this complexity that we see. And so from a Christian point of view, doing science, all of these philosophical assumptions are informed with a biblical worldview.
You know, there's a common criticism of theists from the part of the atheist is that the God that we believe in is the God of the gaps.
Yeah.
That if God, if we can't think of a mechanism for why something is...
God did it.
God did it. So there's a God of the gaps. And I think it was John Lennox, probably others as well, who've pointed out that there's a distinction that needs to be made between a mechanism for explaining some phenomena and the agency that is behind that mechanism. And that when a scientist comes up with a mechanism, maybe even to explain consciousness, that doesn't explain the agent that could be behind the God that we believe in is the agent behind the mechanism that the scientist is discovering.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. When we get into these issues, and I've thought some about this. I mean, when we ask questions like, how do we explain mathematics and logic, and how do we explain human cognition? I would ask the question, what is the best explanation of that? I mean, I don't want to commit the God of the gaps fallacy, but here I'm appealing to this more abductive form of reasoning, mm-hmm. where I'm saying, isn't it more reasonable to conclude that human minds came from a source that had mindfulness, and that the intelligibility of the universe in math and logic, isn't it a better explanation? Isn't it a fuller explanation? Isn't there a certain cogency to say that the source had those qualities and those characteristics, that this source is a being that also has morality? And so I like your comment there, Dave. I don't think we're trying to ignorantly just say, well, God did it. I'm introducing this complex source. No, I'm saying, look, I think this agency that stands behind all of this, mm-hmm. I think it's a needed explanation. I think things come together in that kind of way of thinking. Well, let's look at in my book, Without a Doubt, I have a chapter on aren't Christianity and science enemies, and I have 10 points that I insist are kind of principles that undergird science. We've already kind of alluded to them. I'm going to kind of number them and kind of focus on them with a bit more attention here. But my point here is that if it is historically correct to say, and I believe it is, that science was birthed and nurtured and flourished within the context of a Christian worldview. Now again, don't draw the conclusion that other civilizations and other cultures didn't make contributions. I mean, this kind of intellectual process goes through various centuries. I mean, it is kind of amazing some of the contributions that the Greeks make, you know, to not just to philosophy, but to mathematics, and even the Islamic culture, you know, algebra is an Arabic word, and the ancient Chinese and various other civilizations that make contributions to this kind of this intellectual movement that is moving forward. But the reality is, when you begin to look at a history of science, that there's something unique about the revolution that takes place in the 1600s, the 17th century, and it is in Europe. And it seems that these 10 points, we'll talk about 5 of them and then we'll carry over on the next program, they seem to anticipate, shape, encourage, justify, and sustain the general character and presuppositions of modern science. And I would say the Christian worldview, therefore, undergirds these kinds of things. Now, Dave, when you were at Caltech, did you study the history of science? Did you study the philosophy of science?
No. I mean, you could. I mean, I'm sure there were probably in the humanities department they may have had, but that wasn't a requirement.
Yeah.
It was, you know, you didn't have to study that kind of stuff.
Now, remember that quotation from Paul Davies that we read earlier?
Yeah.
He says, in the ensuing 300 years, the theological dimension of science has faded. That is, the vast majority of scientists that I've interacted with over the last 20 years have told me that there's very little discussion about the history of science, mm-hmm. about the philosophy of science that goes on in a person earning a PhD in a, mm-hmm. in a particular discipline. And so the backdrop of all of this has kind of faded. I mean, I kind of get the impression that people like Stephen Hawking and other people, who's the name I'm looking for, Lawrence Krauss, maybe Krauss more than even Stephen Hawking, but it's almost as if the momentum of science has been produced by a religious worldview, but now that movement of the scientific enterprise is seen as moving almost on its own,
independent of this.
That's right.
This history.
That's right.
We've dropped that. We don't need that anymore. We don't need the religious underpinnings.
Right. Science works.
Science works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Science works. Now, of course, why does it work? How does it work? In what world does it work? And what worldview seems to best explain why it works? All of that seems to be kind of, you know, put aside.
Shuffled to the side.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some who obviously worry about it, but...
Yes.
But for the most part...
As Davies says, the theology of that is faded, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's on the other side.
I was just going to say, Dave, don't they still award doctors of philosophy in science?
Yeah, I have a doctor of philosophy, but I've never had a philosophy course.
Oh, boy.
Interesting. Mm. Okay, well, let's tackle five of these. The first one... And we've already hinted at this. We've already kind of unveiled this. But let's say it directly,
more explicitly.
Yeah. The physical universe is a distinct objective reality. It's a distinct objective reality. Again, if it weren't there, if I adopt Hinduism or I adopt Platonism, and it, you know, it's less than real, how can I do science? But it, from a biblical standpoint, the reason the universe is there is that it has come from God. God created, only the triune God exists, and then God calls all other contingent realities into existence. Creation ex nihilo. And so the universe is a contingent reality, but it's a real reality. It is actually there. It is not subjective. Now, there is this kind of quantum mechanics idea, Dave, where the quantum world actually does seem to be kind of influenced by the observer, you know, that mm-hmm. the observer kind of influences what's happening in the world. But still there is the idea that... that the universe is there, that it's an objective reality, mm-hmm. that people can study it, they can think about it, they can reflect upon it.
We can measure it.
We can measure it. We can weigh it.
This just aside for a second, this idea of, you know, somehow that there's a mysterious thing going on within quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
That, I mean, and there is a mechanistic way of thinking about it that I think helps at least, and that is that if things that we study at the atomic level, they're so small that the tools that we have for studying them are very coarse compared to the... It's like if you were to want to study some, you know, something about your face, for instance, mm-hmm. and all you have is a big knife... And you're going to do some surgery or something on some pimple on your face or something. I mean, that's pretty crude way of what you need is a fine scalpel in order to, you know, and fine needles in order to do this little surgery on your face. You don't need some big, you know, honking knife that you're going to, slip and cut your throat accidentally. But that's the way it is. When you're beginning to study things at that level, at the atomic level, you don't have, I mean, light, for instance, if you shine a light on it, it just blows what you're looking at apart. And so you have to have some very clever techniques to be able to look at these things without destroying them.
Yeah.
And so naturally, if you're looking at something, you're going to influence it.
Yeah.
If an object is moving along at a certain speed and you want to measure its speed and you shine, you throw, suppose a car is running along and you want to see how fast the car is going. And so what you do is you throw other cars at it.
Yeah.
And see how they bounce off. Well, you can maybe in the end tell how originally that car was going, but you've totally destroyed that car in the process,
right,
or its direction, or its. So it's not at all surprising that this kind of phenomena takes place, this uncertainty that happens
when you
begin looking at things at that
level. And that doesn't destroy the fact that it's there, that it's objective, there's a reality there. Okay, very good. Well, look, if the cosmos were somehow less than objective reality, then science would be superfluous, right? That's the first point that we're making there. Our second point is that the laws of nature exhibit order, patterns, and regularity. Orderliness, certain patterns and regularity. I mean, scientists, Dave, they depend upon these things.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the...
It's going to be the same tomorrow.
It's going to be the same tomorrow as it was today. That the world reflects an elegant order, that there are these detectable patterns. We could even talk about a dependable regularity, right? And so we talk about in science self-consistent theories,
mm-hmm,
right? Now, how is it, Joe, that the universe is ordered and patterned and regular? It wouldn't have to be.
It's just the way it is.
It's
a brute reality.
It's just a brute reality.
But it is important.
There's a personal God behind it all.
If it weren't that way, we would not be able to do science.
And thus, if we again tackle that question of what is the best explanation behind it, from a biblical perspective, and again, we also have to give credit to Judaism. We have to give credit to the Jewish approach to the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Hebrew scriptures, Genesis, this idea that, you know, that God is behind the reality, that the fact that the laws, that there are laws and that they are ordered, patterned, and they're regular, that fits pretty well with the idea of a personal God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing I think we would even expect it to be. If not, I mean, if there's no God, then this order seems out of place. It seems almost shocking that we would have, you know, this kind of order. And again, when we think about how the human mind works, things that are ordered, they're regular, we think in terms of pattern, this seems to fit pretty well with the way a infinite, eternal mind would create the universe.
But it is the key thing, though, it is a necessary condition to do science, wherever it comes from.
That's right. Science isn't possible without it.
That's right.
So there is this dependence going on about it. Okay. And again, you can see why people would think that the world mirrors the mind of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is the way the early scientists who held a religious worldview would think. Okay, a third point. The laws of nature are uniform throughout the physical universe.
This is, of course, a thing we've only discovered in recent years.
That's right. Now, Joe, when I think of the word uniform, I think of a baseball team wearing uniforms.
Oh, yeah.
They're all the same.
They're all the same.
They're all the same. Now, if God is behind the universe and he is providentially ordering and governing the universe, then we might expect that there would be an...
Makes sense.
That everything would correspond. There would be a sense in which it makes sense. That's mm-hmm. right. Right.
If we were to discover scientifically that when we look at the Andromeda Galaxy, the laws of physics are totally different than they are here, that would be kind of upsetting. You wouldn't be able to make predictions about what you expect.
Yeah, predictability, right?
And how recently have we known this, Dave?
Well, you know, in the last 100 years.
100 years?
Yeah, I would.
Since Einstein?
Roughly. Well, you know, it's not until the beginning of the 1900s that we began to realize that these objects that we look at in the sky are not part of our own Milky Way galaxy, but are actually way outside our Milky Way galaxy. They call them nebula, and we've discovered in some of those early research, you know, partly by Hubble, that these were actually galaxies outside of our own local galaxy of which we were a part. There are a lot of nebula that are part of our Milky Way galaxy. They call it like the Horsehead Nebula. You've probably heard of that one that looks like, you know, with the colors and so on. But, you know, now we know that the Andromeda Nebula, for instance, is not part of our galaxy, but is 3 million light years away. Mm-hmm. Way outside of our own. Well, we didn't discover that until the beginning of the 20th century.
Mm. All right.
So if we just simply said, and if we said no more, then the fact that the universe, that there is a uniformity to the laws of nature, that makes a lot of sense in a theistic biblical context.
It's allowed cosmology, for instance, so that we're able to figure out, for instance, that the universe had a beginning in the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. If the laws weren't uniform, we wouldn't have been able to make that prediction.
So whether God is responsible for it or not, it fits the pattern of a biblical worldview.
That's right.
It's what we would expect. Now, number four, the physical universe is intelligible. That doesn't mean we understand everything, but the idea that we're capable of understanding things is again, it's not just that the world is ordered, but we can track the order.
That's right.
Here's John Polkinghorne, who is a British physicist and... he is also a Anglican priest. He says, quote, "We are so familiar with the fact that we can understand the world that most of the time we take it for granted. It is what makes science possible, yet it could have been otherwise. The universe might have been a disorderly chaos rather than an orderly cosmos." So there's kind of a sense in which we ask, why is it that way?
Why is it that way, right?
I mean, it's one thing to say, science works. Why does it work? And the early scientist would have said, well, of course it works because it comes from the mind of God, that is intelligible. And again, I go back to that quote by C.S. Lewis, if a mind is behind the universe, then reason is the product of that rational creation.
Yeah. You know, Ken, it just occurs to me that we're having this discussion in the context of our Christianity and science at odds, but it seems to me that if we were having this discussion in the context of just the Christian faith, we could be talking about the glory of God. You know, God gave us brains, and this aspect of the physical universe being intelligible, it's like, isn't that wonderful that God gave God gave us this creation, and he gave us minds. This goes along with the title of this podcast, Imago Dei. It's like, well, is it no wonder that he gave us a brain and he created us in his image, and we have this whole creation so that we can forever discover his creation. Now, that's a different podcast,
but coming at from the other perspective.
But we're all Christians here, so we have that perspective, but now we're talking in a different context here.
Yeah, and of course, in listening to you, I'm struck too by we're focusing on the universe, and we're saying, well, it's there, it's orderly, and we can make predictions, and we can track its intelligibility, but from a biblical point of view, that world is to testify to the glory of God.
Exactly.
That God is
Psalm 19 and other places. Yeah.
The heavens declare the glory of God. Yeah. Number five, the world is good, valuable, and worthy of careful study. I mean, the world could be illusory. The world could be something less than good. It could be a Xeroxed copy. It could be. It could be like airline food. It's not really food. You don't really think this is food, right?
I'm told some airlines are improving on that score.
Well, I think they are. But if the universe were kind of, sub-reality, a biblical point of view would say God made the world. It's a good place. He made it good, and we can track it. We can celebrate it. We can live our, in Him and in His creation. We live out our temporal destiny, if you will.
It's got incredible properties that support life.
Yeah, yeah.
The life itself has got incredible properties of robustness and self-healing and.
Yeah.
All the things that we're able to do as physical human beings, God built into, our capabilities, into the very structure of the DNA and all of this kind of stuff that we've only recently discovered.
Yeah. And so I asked the question, in closing this program, guys, I asked the question, given our surroundings and given the many tools that scientists have to, these great telescopes and now the microscope, which allows us to look so deeply into an area that our eyes weren't able to fully detect, what is it about the universe and what is it about the human mind that people don't ask, why is it the way it is? Where did it come from? Why does it have these qualities? And what is my place in that universe? I mean, it seems difficult, I think, to separate the what questions from then springing into the why questions of asking these kinds of things. And you can see why a scientist who holds a Christian worldview would say, this fits. This is coherent. I can carry out my vocation as a scientist, believing that this is the order that came out of the mind of God. On the other hand, as Hugh Ross has said, it's very easy, I think, to look at the universe and its complexity and see it as kind of an idol factory that you can spend all of your life in. And maybe never get to the questions of the why. Why is the universe here? What explains its complexity? And what is my relationship to the world in which I live? So, Joe, in the next program, we'll continue this kind of exploration about whether Christianity and science have a relationship that should be seen as enemies or as allies. And, of course, I think history and philosophy says there is a very strong allied relationship between science and Christianity.
All right. Looking forward to that. Some of these points, as you mentioned, are taken from your book, Without a Doubt. Is that the right book, Ken?
That's right. I have a chapter in Without a Doubt called Aren't Christianity and Science Enemies? And I've taken these principles, these points here, and of course I've derived them from all kinds of other philosophical and scientific sources, and people are, I recommend they go to Without a Doubt and do some reading.
Okay, you can pick up that book wherever you do your shopping. Certainly highly recommend that book. Ken's latest book is God Among Sages, and Ken's been doing a lot of interviews on that book. You will want to add that to your reading list as well. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.